Welcome back to Final Final. I'm your host, Heather McGee. Today we're talking about human-centered design, great leadership at scale, and how to achieve big things while being nice to people. My guest today, Kara DeFrias, has found herself at the top of every field she's worked in. She has a truly incredible depth of experience that includes the White House, the World Cup, the Super Bowl, the Oscars, and currently in tech for Intuit. She is a storyteller, a leader, an expert in human-centered design, and a truly wonderful human who I feel really lucky to have on the podcast today. Full disclosure, we used to work together for a little bit tangentially, and I learned so much from her. And as a person, it's just such a delightful human to get to know. So I'm so happy and delighted to have you on. All right, Kara, so to start off, you're an expert in human-centered design. Can you talk a little bit about how you scale, what that is, and how you scale that work?
Yes, you know, human-centered design is really about putting the people literally at the center of everything you do. And so what that could look like is, you know, when you are designing a show, for example, something like a TEDx San Diego or TEDx Intuit, it's making sure that, at least in my practice of experience design, are we thinking about how we want people to feel, what we want them to do, what we want them to say right from the beginning, so that all decisions you make after that ladder up to those principles and those kind of true north. And, you know, I'll give you an example. When I put on TEDx San Diego the first time, it became, well, how do we want not just the audience to feel and what do we want them to say, what do we want to do, but like, what do we want the cast, or I mean, in this case, the speakers, right? Like, what do we want the speakers to feel and do? And what do we want the crew to feel? And you kind of, you know, you fill out this table and it really becomes a grounding point for every touch point along the way for people to point back. And I was like, oh, if we do X, will that make somebody feel this way? And the great part about doing that, even in software design or technology, is if you think about your main user, the main person interacting with your product, using your product, you know, by having that human-centered design approach, you're really grounding everybody in the same way, from the coders to the marketers to the UX folks to, you know, the salespeople. And it gives you this unifying rally cry so that we're always, you know, making sure people do it. And even at the White House, you know, we put together the executive order around customer experience, where we worked with all, I think it was 11 agencies that have high touch, high impact interactions between the government and the people, and making sure that those are done in a human-centered way. And, you know, even in the executive order, in the EO, we define what it means to your question around what is human-centered design. And we say that at its simplest, human-centered design is talking to the people who will use your product or service so that you make sure it's usable by them. And then, you know, they could give you positive feedback, like, this is working, so hey, let's not change that. They could let you know what, every time I get to this screen, I trip up on this button or this sentence confuses me. And so by really incorporating the people who use your product or service or interact with your service or product, you're figuring out, because, you know, what makes sense to you is, of course, right in front of your nose because you see it every day, but these people don't. And so it's really about bringing the people into the process.
I love that. Well, and also it makes me think too about, in something that is very highly related, customer empathy. You know, really trying to think about all the different people that are going to use your product, the different perspectives they're coming from. And really, it can be kind of a pitfall where you design for a particular group of people. And then there are completely other groups of people that are also using your product that have different needs. And being able to get in there and understand what they're looking for and what they need and how they need it to function is so critical for launching something that actually matters.
Totally. And, you know, a lot of people, it's funny, I'll talk to some people at conferences that I speak at, and they'll say, well, you know, we have so many users, we couldn't possibly design something for all of them. And I'm like, well, you know who also has a ton of users and is getting really better at it is the federal government. And that's kind of my catchphrase anytime someone says, well, we can't do X. Like, you know, up until recently, a lot of places didn't put salary bands on their job postings, which we know there's data that backs up the fact that if you put salary bans on job posting. It's the easiest way to ensure equity from the get-go if you're looking at an equity perspective. And so, you know, I often have people at other organizations or companies tell me, oh, we could never do that. It's just, you know, we just couldn't. It's not scalable. And I'm like, you know, who does it with the 20 million, you know, 2 million person workforce is the federal government. And, you know, if the government can figure out how to do it, I bet you could. But luckily for us, from that particular perspective, a lot of states, including California, now require if you have more than 15 employees, you have to put your salary range on every job posting, which is just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And that's a great example, again, of human-centered, right? You're centering the person who's interacting at that moment in a way that helps them.
Yeah. There's really been such a shift in marketing over the years, I feel like, whereas for a long time, it was the brand thinking about what they want to say, you know, and that's like first and foremost, who are we? What do we want to say? And I feel like there's been a flip now in terms of the gold standards, like, well, who are you trying to serve? What do they need? What are they looking for? And flipping the script to be much more taking in and supporting the people you're serving rather than, you know, in the past, I think marketing plans to a degree tended to be, well, this is what the brand wants to say. And that was the end of the conversation rather than it being customer first.
Well, and it's interesting you bring that up, Heather, because at the White House, we didn't have a marketing team per se, right? It's the White House. Like people, they're going to follow you on social media. They're going to sign, you know, subscribe to your newsletters. But one of the principles I learned when I was working there for the first time back in 2012 under President Obama that was super interesting was, you know, it's called the Office of Digital Strategy is the team that handles all the online, the videos, the social media accounts. And their whole mantra was meet people where they are, right? And so you might say it a little different on Instagram or Twitter. You might have a different, you know, posting frequency, but how are you meeting people where they are?
Yeah, which is critical. And I also think about something Oprah, I think she might be the originator on this. Every person has a story. And there really is something to that and something to be learned on a personal level and a human level. But then also when you have a group of people or many groups of people that you're serving from a brand perspective.
Yeah, totally. And it's, you know, how are you, I think that's a beautiful sentiment because it's really, you know, how are you drawing their story out of them? Because many of them may not know it. And it's almost, you know, shifting kind of from brand to more like, you know, thinking of my work on the Oscars or something like that. It's what are the stories you're drawing out of people? One of my favorite compliments I've ever gotten is you believed in me more than I could believe in myself, Kara, or when I couldn't believe in myself. And to me, that's a happy moment. That's a moment where I'm like, oh, cool.
That's nice. I love that. Now, and that kind of gets me to my next question. One, you're one of the most effective leaders that I've ever worked with, and you also have worked with other great leaders from around the world. So I would love to hear your perspective on this. What does great leadership look like to you?
It's a great question. First, thank you for the compliment. That's very kind of you to say. I was talking to a friend the other day about leadership, and we were having a conversation on legacy because my undergrad is Elizabethtown College. In the middle of central PA, Amish country. I was just there last week. We had Valerie Jarrett, who served under President Obama for all 8 years in office. In fact, had worked with President Obama and the First Lady before they even got into office. And she also, similar to Oprah, had that thing that we are our stories, right? And the other thing is when we were talking about leadership, there's this really special moment where it's kind of that servant leadership mentality, right? Like, who are you there to serve? How do you show up? So, you know, when you're thinking about what does great leadership look like, I think, you know, as I was telling my friend, I don't ever want to be remembered as somebody who hit their numbers. Like, that is the least important thing to me, that I hit a metric or I did, you know, great delivering on, you know, whatever the product goal was. To me, it's that moment of, I saw the person, I helped the person, I empowered them to do their job in a way, but also, you know, came in with it, you know, come, I think where a good leader shines is you have a strong vision and you rally the team and empower them to achieve that vision with you, because at the end of the day, we spend so much time at work, and really, you know, if we're not having some fun along the way and enjoying the people that we're with, and I don't think that sounds very fun. So I think for me, I just try to show up authentically, vulnerably, You know, when I had my three cancers, like I told my coworkers, because I can't separate something like that from who I am at work. And so I think good leaders are authentic. I think they're vulnerable when appropriate. I think they know how to rally the team. I mean, it's one of the reasons Ted Lasso was a runaway hit, right? You've got the coach, Ted, played by Jason Sudeikis, who is vulnerable finally, because he's kind of got this, like, you know, for folks who haven't seen it, he's got this like aw shucks, cornbread, American football coach kind of attitude. But when he really starts to get vulnerable, his team chooses to get vulnerable with him, and that makes them a better team. And so, you know, and I will qualify. Like, I know a lot of this has privilege baked in, right? Like, some people aren't in positions where they can, or there's imbalances in power. And that's part of my thing with some people who go down the textbook leadership definition. At least I did in my leadership journey in the past 10 years, I've learned from listening to people who are smarter than me that are working with me or in my org. You know, when the previous president took power, before President Biden, there was people saying, well, you know, if you stay in government, then you must agree with him. And it's not that easy. A good leader will recognize that, you know what, some of these people may be the only breadwinner for their family and the only insurance carrier, and they have special needs children or are taking care of a spouse or a parent or a partner. And so it's not easy. And so, you know, that's sometimes when you hear some of these people who are propped up as like the great leader beacons we should all be following, and they're the ones shouting loudest from the stage. What's missing for me in a lot of those leadership lessons is the acknowledgement of privilege and the acknowledgement of circumstances that don't make it easy to do some of the things they're shouting about. And so, you know, I try to learn every day from the people I work with. And I think those have been some of my more powerful lessons, especially probably since 2016, 2015.
Yeah. Well, you're making me think about, and it's related to our conversation we had a few minutes ago. I heard the term a few years ago, human first leadership, which sounds like table stakes, but not everybody comes to the table that way. And you're really making me think about that. And when you look at it through that lens, a lot of things change. Like in the past, people have used language like, I want to treat everyone equally. It's better to treat everyone fairly because everyone has different needs and has different things going on. And it changes a lot of the ways you come to work every day when you think about it as a human first responsibility rather than being prescriptive about the needs of the company. Finally, when we support our teams the way that they need to be supported, somehow we actually have better results, I think.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, interesting. I haven't heard human first leadership. I think it's probably like a kissing cousin to like servant leadership, right?
Yeah.
It is. It's interesting you bring up the whole equally, right? Because I think I've seen a shift, at least in the past few years, away from equal and more toward equitable.
Yeah.
And that's something in the Biden-Harris White House, especially in the first 6 months, we really made sure we repeated that message because, yeah, equal, if somebody's already, you know, on third base because they hit a triple, because there's many reasons they hit that triple, and someone's having a hard enough time getting to first base with a single, to use some baseball analogies, if you equally gave them XYZ, it wouldn't advance equity, right? We really tried to bake equity into every action, every executive order, every interaction with what we were trying to accomplish through policies with agencies and others. And I think if you can start from that place of thinking, again, going back, thinking about the people and how will what we put in place help them. You know, there's a, I wish I could remember, a few years ago, I heard a talk from somebody who they were saying, you know, and talking about equity, equality, fairness. They were saying that there's a difference between kind and nice.
Yeah.
And my friend Jordan Green had this amazing Twitter rant about like East Coast nice versus West Coast nice. And they're a phenomenal human and one of my favorite people on the planet. But, you know, the difference between like you'll say you'll do something for somebody, then you'll never actually follow up, versus showing up kind of at their house.
Yeah.
With like, what can I help you move? And I think, again, I just, part of me envies our parents' generation, where it was like work was work, was home was home. Never the twain shall meet. And I just, it's such a difference to now try to separate it, right? Yeah. And that's where, like, if somebody's suffering at home and you're not taking on that servant leader mentality to want to understand what those challenges or barriers might be, then, you know, a lot of places I think say show up as your whole self at work. I don't know how many places I'm proud to work for a place, you know, Intuit really does, in my mind, live that bring your whole self to work. But I mean, I think maybe part of what we're saying here is, like, it goes back to, is the leader strong enough to admit they don't know what they don't know and then go out and seek other data or articles or videos or whatever to really be the leader that's required today to lead efficiently and effectively?
Yeah, that's for sure. In a much more supportive way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, something I think that's really cool about you is you have gotten yourself into a position to do some really cool things in a lot of different fields, you know, from sports, entertainment, to government, to big tech. It's really incredible. Can you talk a little bit about the role of reinvention and what that's played in your career and your life?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was at a conference about a year and a half ago now, and it's this really cool conference where it's a weekend of curated conversations. They look at everybody's bios and they say, oh, this person, this person, this person, we should have them talk about X. It'll be a really cool conversation. Then you attend these different conversations throughout the weekend. And so for, like, the former producer and executive producer and me, like, I nerd out with stuff like this. I'm like, oh, this is amazing. What a great, cool weekend of content. And so I was invited to the opening plenary, and the moderator is introducing me, and they say, like, all the kind things you've been saying so far today. And thank you again. And I just get up there. And the reality is, it's not imposter syndrome, Heather, but it's just like, it blows my mind when I hear those things. I'm like, that sounds like a really cool person. Where are they at? But what I told people on stage that day, and it's kind of become my catch line because it helps ground me, is I just say, I'm a kid from Jersey that was supposed to be a high school English teacher and coach soccer. Like, that's what you have to remember about me. And, you know, when I think about how I got to do all these cool things, like, there's two lessons that come to mind. One, ever since I can remember, my mother has always told me, always ask, the worst I can say is no. Mm. Because it's the truth, right?
Yeah.
And then the second part is, my mantra's become always say yes. And one of the cool things, and when I was given a talk last week at my alma mater at Elizabethtown College, it was fun because what I realized in giving this talk around, it's called The Art of Reinvention. And what I realized is, I had a lot of cool volunteer opportunities that turned into paid gigs, mm-hmm. right? Like, volunteering on the press operations team for Women's World Cup 99 is what got my foot in the door for being head of community relations for the San Diego Spirit. Working in that role, you know, when I was in San Diego, Super Bowl came to town. I volunteered for the host committee. Because of my experience, they put me in charge of the halftime show for the host committee. I had 80 volunteers under me. That led to the Oscars gig, which was a paid gig, right? And so what I really tried to impress upon the undergrads last week was, volunteer for stuff that you really dig in and missions you really believe in, because you never know where it could lead. And obviously I told them, like, don't volunteer because you want something cool to come out of it. Volunteer because it feels good and you're doing cool things. And I think that's where, for your question, like, the reinvention was just, something cool came up. It was in front of me. I thought it was neat. So I applied to it and I got it. And, like, every time that comes up in my life, I'm just like, well, that looks cool. I want to go try it. And it just became this kind of ping pong or pinball machine track of a career that if you know, I look back now, because we think, you know, vision boards are hot and all that stuff, and I'm just like, there was no vision board that looked anything like this. Like, I couldn't have imagined in my wildest dreams. Who could? That's wild. Yeah. Like, these are wild, and it's not lost on me. It's funny, the first time I worked in the White House in 2012, you know, it wasn't lost on me that there was, like, poli-sci majors at many, many colleges and universities across the country who would give their left leg to be working there. And here I am, somebody who double majored in theater and English, like, doop, 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 doop. How y'all doing?
Same.
But I will, right? Like, but, you know, I think I don't think I know the theater part of my undergrad is what gave me the confidence and the courage and where I found my voice to be able to say yes to all those things, to have the courage to ask because the worst they could say is no. You know, every year on Mother's Day, I post the same thing on Instagram. I say, because of her, it never occurred to me that I couldn't do or be anything I set my mind to. And
oh,
it's the truth.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. Yeah. I love that. There's a, I recently had another friend of mine on this podcast. She is a e-commerce global lead for TikTok right now, Sylvia Esmundo. She was also a theater kid, and she's also had a bit of a nonlinear career. And the way she put it, which I also thought was pretty cool, she said, I've just always followed my curiosity. She said, sometimes people look for prestige, or they're like, oh, that's the next rung on the ladder. She was like, I just looked for things that felt interesting and where I would learn something. And somehow that's ended up with me having this great career of my dreams. And it was just by following my heart. And I thought that was really well put too. I like that.
Totally. Well, and that's the thing. I think, you know, I've said to people on a number of occasions, Heather, that it's not that I, you know, had any career aspirations in any of these fields. It just, they seem like, you know, the world's a big place and there's a lot of cool stuff to try.
Yeah.
And you get one go around on this planet in your one precious life. And how are you choosing to make it as fulfilling as possible to you? Right. Like, you know, when I was talking to the undergrads, I said, you've got to be, and you'll know this working for Oprah, like you have got to be okay being the person that gets the coffee, being the person that gets the, you know, makes the photocopies or does the lunch runs, because that's where you're going to actually learn a lot about leadership, about human dynamics, about human interactions. And, you know, people know I was head of community relations for the San Diego Spirit women's professional soccer team. What they may not know, though, is I started out as the receptionist because that was the job opening.
Yeah.
And you know what? 6 weeks after I started, they promoted me. You know, you could sit there and say, oh, you have a, you know, bachelor's degree and you were a receptionist. So what? I believe in the mission. I believe in the org. I'm passionate about the work. I literally would be your janitor. That's another one. TEDx San Diego. So this was 2010. It was one of the first 50 TEDx's in the world. I'd been watching TED Talks for years at that point. We all had, right? And I heard we were getting a TEDx, this new program they were launching, this grand experiment. You know, fast forward 13 years later, there's like been over, I think, 20,000 around the world. But we were one of the first 50. So I went to the TEDx San Diego website and I filled out the volunteer form. And I said, I don't care. I will be your janitor. I just want to be involved. And by the way, if it's helpful, I've worked on the Oscars and the Emmys and the Super Bowl.
By
you
way.
Know, 5 minutes later, Jack Abbott calls me, the organizer, and is like, will you be our director? And I was like, yes. You know, and then I started TEDx Intuit, executive produced that for 6 years. But again, a volunteer opportunity that led to something. So I think that's something else where, you know, when you think about how might I reinvent myself, let's say that you want to work as a coder or you want to work as a florist, I don't know, something, right? I tell people all the time, like, find places in your local communities that could use your skills, donate your time to them, make it sound super fancy on your resume by saying you did it pro bono, which is just a super 50-cent word for saying volunteer. And you know, that's how you can also get experience. You don't just get experience in the job. You can get experience through volunteering. And that's that, like I said, that was a nice thing to realize that, like, wow, a lot of the cool things I have been fortunate to work on did start off. There was a seed somewhere from a volunteer opportunity.
Yeah, I love that. Now, this kind of leads us really well into something I wanted to ask you about. And you have a personal connection to this. You alluded to it a bit before, that one of your great achievements in your career has been working on Cancer Moonshot. Can you explain, I don't know that everybody knows what that is. Can you kind of explain what that is and then what you learned from your work on that project?
Cancer Moonshot was announced at the January 2016 State of the Union, which for those of your listeners who may not be familiar with that, globally, State of the Union is what happens once a year. The President of the United States goes before Congress and gives their speech on what is the state of America. What are the highs? What are the lows? What are they optimistic about? What is the path forward? And so this was President Obama's final State of the Union. And about two-thirds of the way through, you know, State of the Union, just to like government nerd sidebar for a second, State of the Union's always funny because until I worked in the White House, I didn't realize how much work goes in it. I mean, you're talking like 6 months of like agencies and cabinet secretaries and people at the White House, like everyone is gunning to get their project mentioned in State of the Union, also called SOTU. So that aside, so about two-thirds of the way through the State of the Union in 2016, President Obama announces, you know, we are going to be the country that cures cancer once and for all. And now we're going to launch this thing called a cancer moonshot. And in his words, we're putting Joe in charge of mission control. Now, he kind of turns around the lectern because it's State of the Union, and the vice president and the Speaker of the House sit behind the president and are on camera the whole time. So he turns around to Vice President Biden and he says, I'm putting Joe in charge. And there's a surprised look on Biden's face because he actually didn't know until that moment. And so that was the announcement of the cancer moonshot. And they quickly put together a small team in the vice president's office. I was asked to come over because, in their words, they needed a creative technologist, which is like, I work in tech now, but my background is a lot of creative roles, quite frankly, user experience design, you know, production work, entertainment, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was brought over. I was director of experience design. And, you know, we quickly pivoted. We, you know, the way DC works is, you know, everyone loses their job on January 20th after an election year. That's the day that, you know, you change presidents. And we knew we potentially only had 11 months to do this project.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah. So for folks who are Marvel fans out there, the thing I say is, you know, we made sure to set up the project and the initiative in such a way that regardless of who won the presidential election that year, if it was a friendly handover to a Democrat or an unfriendly to a Republican, you know, even if you cut one head off of the initiative, the other six, like Hydra, would still be able to go on. And so, you know, the goal of the moonshot, and literally, you know, President Obama announced it, was let's be the country that cures cancer. Once we got the team together, we're like, okay, what's the actual realistic goal for the next 11 months? And, you know, we reframed the goal to be, let's make 10 years worth of advances in cancer in the next five. And so that really was the goal of the moonshot, was how might we bring together the fierce and the might of the White House and the administration across, you know, all government agencies to advance this fight against cancer. And my particular area of focus was cancer clinical trials and things like, you know, if you go to trials.cancer.gov, we totally reimagine the front and the back end of that. And then my other job, so that was half of my job. My other job was the digital strategy for the moonshot. And the way I sum that track of work up is, how might we connect the moonshot to the people, right? How might we get as many voices from around the country into the moonshot to influence it? And so that included launching a Medium publication where it was so fun. It was so fun, Heather. Like when you call people and you're like, hi, I'm Kara DeFreitas from the White House. Would you be interested in writing a blog post on Medium that we're going to put in the Cancer Moonshot publication? And then like, everyone's like, yes. Oh my God, when do you need it by?
So that was right now.
Like that was, yeah, like 5 minutes ago, if you've got it. But like, and you're calling like big people and small people and famous people and not famous people. And it's just, you know, when I talked earlier about like, you know, the White House doesn't have a marketing department, like you really don't need one. Like everyone's already paying attention to you, right? Which is like the goal of marketing. And so it was really fun to be on point for bringing the voice in. One of my most heartening moments in my job was, you know, we have an office of presidential correspondence, and every day the White House receives tens of thousands of letters, like actual letters and emails. And this office reads all of them. And under President Obama, he wanted to hear from the people every day. There's this thing called the President's Daily Brief, and it's this book that goes up to the president every night. And it's like, you know, here's what's going on. Here's what you know about your meetings tomorrow. But at the back of the book, he always insisted there would be 10 letters from everyday Americans.
Oh.
So every night, President Obama would get these 10 letters, and they were organized around like whatever the themes were that he was most, you know, into or wanting to know more about, and to really bring in that voice of the people. And so I reached out to that office and I said, I want every single letter that has come to the president or the vice president in the past 2 years that has the word cancer in it. And so I read all of them. And then again, going back to human-centered design, every Monday morning at 8 a.m., I would send one letter out to the Cancer Moonshot team, to all 10 of us, to ground us who we were here for and who we were showing up for. And reading those letters was just, I mean, it's disheartening because there's so many challenges we artificially put in front of people, like not having universal healthcare, right? But then it's also so heartwarming because there's people who want the president and the vice president to know, like, I'm here for the fight. I'm here with you. How can I help? And so, you know, we reached out to a number of them, and some of them we brought to the White House. Some of them we had design studios around the country as we did our research for Cancer Moonshot. And, you know, there was one that just really broke all of us. Her name is Jennifer, and she had been diagnosed with a pretty aggressive form of cancer. And the line that breaks me every time I think about her letter is, she said, I have so much more to give the world than 3 years would allow, right? And so when I talk about us having like an 11-month potential deadline to on this project, it's like, what is even 11 months in the course of 3 years?
Yeah.
What is 3 years in the course of a lifetime? And so it was the absolute honor and privilege of my life to be able to work on Cancer Moonshot.
That's incredible. I had seen you posting about it a little bit and seen it in the news and all those things. So I thank you for sharing that. It's, man, it, yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking about the, some of the impact that you've made on, and I know that was personal for you as well, about these things that we do matter. You know, like it's so easy to feel like, what can I do? It's not going to impact anyone. No one cares. You know, it's just me and my own little life. But the reality is there's a lot that we can do that can make a big impact on other people, make other lives better, make our lives better. That actually what we do can matter, you know, and that's definitely a good example of that.
You know, it could be as something you don't know that even saying hi to somebody that you pass on the street, you could have made their day. You don't know that, you know, that $5 you gave to the nonprofit that you love in your neighborhood, or the free library you put up so people have a book. You just, you know, if you can just try to put kindness out in the world, you really don't know whose life you're about to save or what difference you can make. I remember when this last go around the White House, over the past year and a half, I was put on the Child Tax Credit launch team. And I did the digital and the content strategy for it. What it means is, so every year, parents get a tax credit when they file their taxes for the previous year. And what we realized really quickly when we got in the White House, and we had known it pretty much on the campaign trail as well, that, you know, people are struggling financially. The pandemic was really hard on so many of us. You know, some people just couldn't wait that long to get that, you know, that $3,000, $2,000 credit. And so we just pulled half of it forward. And what that means is, so starting on July 15th of 2021, we pulled half of it forward, we divided it by six, and you started getting monthly checks. And I'll never forget, on July 15th, I wake up and my cell phone is blowing up from friends and family, like, money just appeared in my bank account. Did you have something to do with that? which was fun. And it was fun to, you know, help people. You know, we lifted, I think the number is 40 million, 60 million families and kids out of poverty. Like, that's big. It's huge, right? And so, you know, there's a lot of good that can be done in DC. And I think it's so easy and lazy to collectively rag, but some of the finest humans I've ever met are our civil servants, our career civil servants. And they are truly doing the Lord's work in DC and in your state, wherever you live, listeners, and in your cities and towns, wherever you live, audience. And those are people to thank too, right? You know, it's a hard career. It pays awful, awful for these career civil servants who deserve so much more because they do so much for us, right?
Yeah.
So that's the other thing I learned in my time in DC, is just really how outstanding our federal service employees are, and it was such an honor to serve alongside them each of the times I was there.
That's amazing. Now, I love what you have to say about getting things done while being nice at the same time. Can you speak to your perspective on that?
Yeah, it's definitely the biggest lesson I learned from President Obama and Vice President Biden the first time around, is, you know, you see these people and you know, people under leaders emulate their leaders. Right. And so really, top to bottom in the White House was people who were extraordinarily kind and cared deeply about the work they were there to do. And I've also been fortunate in my career to have a number of leaders I worked either for or with who really role modeled that you can be kind and still get stuff done. And it really, there's the big swings, right, that you can do, the grand gestures, but I have found the most effectiveness and the deepest feels happen when it's the moments that matter. And I've heard people say to me, well, I don't know, you know, how would I know how somebody wants to be recognized? And I was like, I don't know, crazy idea. You could go ask them. take them out to coffee or just, you know, because some people will be mortified if they got called out in all hands and their, you know, name and picture up on the screen. It would mean so much more to them to get an email from you or flowers or a gift card, right? And so it starts with actually learning what your people react to and what they want. You know, it's about respecting their agency and asking them. And you know, going down to kind of these micro moments, like for me, I used to say, you know, somebody would ask me, I get asked a lot because I'm a longtime content person and speech writer and writer. My first job out of college was a reporter and photojournalist. And so I've always just been around words or used, I mean, we all use words, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I actually got paid to do it. So when I get asked to do edits, I used to start editing and it takes a lot of time, right? Because I'm a former editor of an entertainment website. And so like, it was my job. And what I've learned to like set my own boundaries now is I'll ask, what type of feedback was the most helpful? Do you want broad narrative feedback? Do you want copy edits? Do you want, like, what do you want? And more often than not, people are like, oh, you know, like, does the flow work? Does the narrative work? And so I used to say, here's my edits, which is it's a power dynamic, right? And so I learned from one of my former bosses, she always used to reply with, here's some considerations. Aww. And it's the same thing. They're getting the feedback they asked for, but it's just that small tweak of a word of like, here's some things to consider, or here's some thoughts I had. And the other thing I would say is I know I have a strong personality and I know I can come in hot sometimes. Like I just know that about myself. And I've also been told that, but I also know it about myself. And so the other thing I've done over the past probably 10 years to diffuse the situation is also say, here's the feedback and feel free, take what's useful, discard what doesn't make sense for you. Either way, my feelings won't be hurt. And then it gives them the opportunity, so they don't feel like they have to, quote unquote, take my feedback. And so there's just some like little tricks along the way, but I mean, it all adds up to, if you're thinking about the person receiving what you're saying and doing, and you're thinking about them and how they might feel about how it's all going on, one, that goes back to human-centered design, and two, it goes back to, you're really just trying to be kind.
Yeah. I learned about something I had never heard about before yesterday. I'm in grad school. There was a whole lecture about this. It's something called, we've all heard the golden rule. Treat other people the way you want to be treated. I heard about something new that I like even better called the platinum rule. Treat people the way they want to be treated. I love that.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because that goes back into the privilege that we talked about earlier. Because if you're somebody who has always been handed what you've wanted, the way you might want to be treated is you always get what you want. For other people, they might not know how to receive that.
Yeah.
Because they've always had to fight for what they wanted or what they've, you know, gotten in work or life. And so I like that idea of like, how might they want to be treated?
Yeah, I liked that a lot. I hadn't heard that before and I really liked it a lot. Now for you, this is an interesting question. I always Yeah, this next one. It is.
Spoiler alert.
Yes, spoiler alert. For you, what was your biggest failure? And what role do you feel failure plays in good work?
Yeah, you know, it's I've done some dumb crap in my career for sure. And I think failure is a loaded word that immediately brings you down. It's kind of like how people use the word hate. Like that means something. And I think we use it so casually now. So for me, it's less failure and time, more times like I tripped up and I probably wouldn't do it the same way again, right? Like, I don't know. It's funny. There's a book growing up called Anne of Green Gables. It's about this redhead called Anne Shirley. And she talks too much. She has a temper, but she tries so hard and her heart is in the right place all the time. And so I, of course, being a redhead and someone who talks a lot, my second grade report card said, Kara likes to talk, period. A lot, period. You know, I really identified with Anne Shirley and my friends when I'm getting kind of like down about things or I'm not sure about a new role or if I can do something. One of my two friends who are also big Anne fans, they say, you know, they just text me and say, "You've never failed at anything, Anne Shirley." I know, oh, I know. That, lower lip wobble.
That was one of my favorite books when I was a kid.
Right. So it's just like, I don't know that I've had astronomical failures, but I've definitely done dumb shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard someone talk about this a few weeks ago about failing forward, meaning learning the lessons you learn out of it, whether they, you know, a mistake you made, someone else made, you know, like, well, what can we take away from this that's helpful?
So, you know, what's interesting about that, Heather, is we're all, I'm going to imagine the royal, we are all familiar with Brené Brown. If you aren't, TED speaker who talks about the power of vulnerability, right? And she's got this mechanism. So this kind of goes into your failure point. She's got this thing that I use now all the time. And so let's say we fail or we did something wrong. We start living in our head about how terrible the thing we just did is, when in reality, probably the person we interacted with who was affected is not telling the self the same story. And so she's got a little rubric that I use a lot now. It's called the story I'm telling myself. And what you do is you go to the person who either you think you've wronged or you interacted with and thought it went bad or not well. And you just say to them, "Heather, the story I'm telling myself is the reason you didn't ask me on your podcast for so long is that you don't like me." And then it gives you the opportunity to be like, "No, I didn't think you'd be interested in coming on." Right. And like we talk about it, and then it gets it out of living in your head and it gives you a chance to clear the air. Right. And so like, I think even with failure, like it's a great opportunity, like talk to your boss or your mentor or your sponsor or your whoever, right? And your person, and be like, "Man, this went that way. And the story I'm telling myself is XYZ." And they could tell you, if it's the person you interacted with or who observed whatever happened, they could be like, "No, dude, what happened was this." Or, you know, your person could give you a different point of view and say, "Well, actually, you know what? I heard they had a bad day this morning. So it wasn't you at all."
Yeah. It's funny. The thing I've always been, there's a really great documentary by Sarah Polley called Stories We Tell. And it's the story of her family. And what she did was she interviewed different family members to say, "I want you to talk to me about our mom." And they all told totally different stories of the same things.
Wow.
And so that was her whole point of view, is that who is a person? Is it who lives in your memory? Is it what really happened? Is it somewhere in between? And I just thought, I mean, it's a really beautiful documentary. I recommend it to anyone who is in the market. But I thought that was a really good example of, I'm convinced that things happen a certain way. And then you talk to someone else who is there and they're like, "That's not what I saw or what I experienced." And it's just kind of interesting to see both of those.
And fun fact, Miss Sarah Polley was on Avonlea, the Canadian series that was a spinoff of Anne of Green Gables.
I forgot about that. Did you read The Story Girl? Do you know what I'm talking about?
You know, so Lucy Maud Montgomery, for those listening, is the author of the Anne of Green Gables series. And the longer the books went on, in my opinion, the more wackadoodle and less interesting they got. And then when they got to the whole like Island and Avonlea series, it just went off the rails. So no, I did not read The Beyond.
I forgot about that one. I forgot about the Island of Avonlea. Yeah. I read it all at the age of like 9 and 10, blew through all
and
of
like,
it.
We are not going to get into my feels about how awful the Anne with the E series is on Netflix and how much they just blew Anne's heart into smithereens. It was disgusting. The adaptation was awful and the direction they went in. I saw two episodes. I'm like, nope, peace done.
I can't. I'm just going to watch one with Megan Follows. That's my heart,
right?
In the classic. And
right?
I can't watch anything else. I'm done.
100% agree.
All right. So I have a big question. Our final question, spoiler alert. This one's a big one.
I'll be the judge of that.
Okay. What do you know for sure in work or in life?
Ooh. Wow.
That's a big one, right?
No. Yeah. Like total, like, yeah. 10 points to Gryffindor for that one. Total big one. What do I know for sure? I know for sure that I was put on this earth to do the most good for the most people. That's what I know in my heart. And to me, my life will feel to me like it was a life well led if, again, at the end of the day, I used my skills to contribute to a world where it's better than when I found it, which I sometimes, I don't know, when I hear people say that, it sometimes catches me in a way where I'm like, oh, you're so special. You left a whole entire world better than you found it. And so I think it's finding your neck of the woods that you can influence in a way that does it. And, you know, for me, what I used to know for sure is that I wanted to be a mom. What I used to know for sure that I'd be an amazing mom. And then my second cancer and subsequent health issues that happened after that made that not a reality. And then, you know, at a certain age, you just realize it's not in the cards. And that was hard for a long time. And what I hold in my heart is what a friend told me, which is, you know, she had been following my journey to motherhood really closely and been a huge cheerleader. And it broke her heart when it wasn't in the cards for me anymore. And I remember she called me and said, you know, I was just to my doctor's office and I was telling him about your journey and how upsetting it was for me. And what the doctor said was, well, maybe your friend Kara wasn't put on this earth to have her own kids. Maybe your friend Kara was put in this world to make it better for everyone's kids.
Well, you definitely have done that from where I sat.
Thank you. And I hold that near and dear to my heart. So I think, you know, what I know to be true is I hope that I continue to get the opportunities to do the most good for the most people.
That's great. Is there anything we haven't talked about today that's important for you to bring up?
You know, Madeleine Albright has a great saying that there's a special place in hell for women that don't support women. And I would just love to give huge kudos to you, Heather, for creating this space on this podcast to have really deep, thoughtful, fun conversations with women, and that you are doing the good work of lifting up other women and their voices. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you. I'm so glad to have you on. I've been so thankful to met a lot of really cool, interesting people throughout this podcast with really great lessons to share. And I thank you for coming on and sharing everything you've learned and that you've been through and experienced. So thank you for that. I'm happy you're here and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks everyone. We'll see you next time. Ready to level up your next version? You can find more Final Final at www.heathermcgee.com or at Instagram with Final Final the Podcast. We are also available for one-on-one coaching and consulting. Send a note to Heather at heathermcgee.com to learn more.